Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is TJ Geist. He is the principal advocate at ALSUP and has more than 21 years of experience with ALSUP and its subsidiaries. He oversees an expanding team of claims consultants who support customers at the initial application and reconsideration levels of the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. The team he oversees represents a combined 450 years plus of experience in disability services, including professionals formerly with the Social Security Administration and state disability determination services. Throughout his career at ALSUP, TJ has worked at the hearing and appeals council levels where he represented claimants before administrative law judges with written briefs and during in-person hearings. His experience also includes serving as director of operations for ALSUP Employment Services, a national SSA-authorized employment network where he helped SSDI recipients return to work using the Ticket to Work program. He holds a bachelor's degree in exercise science from Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, and is a certified pay representative with the Social Security Administration. TJ, welcome to SpondyCast, and today we are going to talk about navigating the path to Social Security disability for spondylitis patients. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I cannot complain. I am very curious, before we get into the top of the questions, how did you get into this work? And did you ever, did you have a plan?
I did not, no. So I was out of college, out of SIU Carbondale. There are two SIUs, and I there's Edwardsville and Carbondale, and I went to Carbondale, which is a little further south in the state of Illinois.
I didn't know that existed.
And the Salukis. The mascot at SIU Carbondale. And so out of college, I started working at bank, and a friend of mine had been working for ALSUP for many years and was looking for other employment. He said, you should apply. And that's how I ended up at ALSUP. And it's been a good career for the last 21 years. So really been gratifying to help people who were in need. So
I can imagine that is a very difficult time if you have to go through that process.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what you do every day, especially at the disability helpline, and how you help people who are looking to apply for disability.
Sure. So ALSUP is a nationwide provider of Social Security disability representation. So it's not just the Midwest, but we have representatives throughout the country, and we help people all over the country. We've been helping individuals obtain their Social Security disability benefits for 40 years now. This is our 40th anniversary, and we represent claimants throughout the entire administrative level of the process. So we'll get into it as we talk, I'm sure, but there are four basic levels of the process, from that initial application all the way to the point where if it has to go to a hearing before an administrative law judge, which includes at that point telling the decision maker finally, after many years of going through the process, why they're not able to work. And so right now I'm overseeing the representatives who represent claimants directly. During my career, I have represented claimants through that initial from that initial application process all the way through the hearing level. But right now it's overseeing the department that helps individuals apply and get their benefits.
Awesome. And okay, so Social Security disability benefits are designed for people who need disability as part of the federal Social Security.
Correct.
And so if you are a person, for our audience, with spondylitis, how does that impact a person's eligibility for benefits?
Yeah, so there are basic eligibility requirements to qualify for Social Security disability, and SSDI is the acronym, and SSDI stands for Social Security Disability Insurance. So it's an insurance program, and so one eligibility requirement is you have to be insured to qualify. And the way people are insured is that through FICA taxes. A portion of your FICA taxes goes towards the disability program. There are really two federal programs through Social Security. One is SSDI, the other is SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And that one you don't have to be insured. And that one also has a needs-based criteria to it. But that's the basic requirement, the basic eligibility requirement. The basic definition for disability is you also have to not be working presently. And you have to be out of work for at least 12 months or expected to be out of work for at least 12 months to qualify. Those are the two basic criteria. In order to be insured, I have to essentially have been working 5 out of the last 10 years. That's a good high-level way to determine whether or not you would be eligible and insured for SSDI.
Okay, interesting. In terms of criteria, if you're a person with spondylitis, applying, what would Social Security look for in a claim?
Yeah. So for any disability claim, Social Security evaluates that using the 5-step sequential evaluation process. So there are 5 steps they go through. Step number one is, are you working? So if you're working, you're not going to qualify. They deny the claim. Step number two is, do you have a severe medically determinable impairment? And so what they're looking for is medical evidence to show that you have spondylitis. So they're looking for things like imaging, exam reports. They're looking for treatment history. They're looking for functional limitations. So Social Security is a medical records-based program. It's also about your ability to function, not necessarily about the diagnosis. So for spondylitis, again, they're looking for things like imaging, x-rays, MRIs, things of that nature. Other types of testing, treatment history, diagnosis from your doctor. And that has to be from an acceptable medical source. That's what they call it, an acceptable medical source, meaning it has to be a doctor or a DO, basically. That's documented in your medical records that you have that condition. It has to be severe, meaning it has an impact on your ability to work. So if you have those two things, you would move past step two and you'd move on to step three. Step three is the first place where Social Security can make a favorable decision and determine that you are disabled. At that point, they determine whether or not your severe impairment meets the criteria outlined in what they call the Blue Book. It used to be an actual Blue Book that they just published on an annual basis. Okay. And in that Blue Book, there were conditions under each body system. If you had a diagnosis under that body system, then and it met the criteria under that condition, under that diagnosis, then they would say, you meet a listing, we're going to approve your case. That book moved online many, many years ago now, but you can still Google it. If you Google Blue Book, Social Security, it'll pop up and you can see the different body systems and you can see the different conditions under that body system. So for example, body system one is musculoskeletal. So if you have a musculoskeletal condition, it would be under that. Spondylitis actually would be under body system 14, which is an immune disorder. And so you'll find in like inflammatory arthritis, it's going to be evaluated under that body system and that condition. So if the condition meets the listing, then Social Security would stop the claim. They would approve it. They would award your case. If it does not meet a listing, doesn't mean they deny it at that point. They would move on to step four. And step four is, can you, based on the limitations you have as a result of your condition, perform your past relevant work? Past relevant work is any work that you have done in the past. But the way they define that is they used to define it as 15 years. So any work that you've done in the last 15 years, could you do that work based on the restrictions you have? And one of the things I think we'll talk about is recent policy changes. One policy change that is very recent, just within the last couple of weeks, is they've shortened that time frame from 15 years to 5 years, which is a good change because
That's
if you
great.
Think about it. Yeah, work that you've done 15 years ago, is that really relevant today? Could you still perform that job? Is it still performed the same way it was 15 years ago? Not likely. So that's one positive change. So they're looking at the last 5 years, the work that you've done in the last 5 years, and they're going to take the restrictions that you have, and they're going to determine that based on the medical records and any functional limitations that are outlined in the medical records, and come up with what they call an RFC, a residual functional capacity. That's the most you can do based on your restrictions. And so they might say something like, well, you can sit for 6 hours, stand and walk for two, and lift 10 pounds. That would be a sedentary RFC. It means you're limited to sedentary work. So if you don't have any past relevant work that was sedentary, maybe all the work you did in the past was required you to be on your feet, they would move on to step five. And that is, can you do any other work? This is the second place. So step five is the second place that Social Security can make a favorable decision. And that is, can you do other work, or do you have transferable skills to do any other type of work?
Okay.
So I said a lot there, but step two is really key. And it's do you have a severe medically determinable impairment? That's a medical records-based program. And so and I mentioned acceptable medical source. Examples of doctors that would not be an acceptable medical source would be like a chiropractor. That's the easiest example to use. Social Security will still look at that, and it's still relevant, but you have to be seeing a medical doctor or a DO in order for them to establish that you have a severe medically determinable impairment.
Okay. So as people are going through this process, are there any best practices related, say, to spondylitis or other, to improve your chances of successful application? And I'm going to the truth piece, right? Like those
are. Obviously you want to just, that's the goal is to, and one of the things there, when you talk about just describing why you're not able to work or limitations, is likely individuals who are applying for disability have been living with this condition for a long time before they have to actually stop working, and they've adjusted. So if Social Security says, can you clean your house? They might just say yes, because they can clean the house, but they've adjusted, and they don't do it the same way they did prior to their diagnosis. And so they can only do it at 10-minute increments. But what they say to Social Security is, yes, I can do it. They don't explain it further. And so make sure you give details. Describe how your limitations or your symptoms change the way you do things. It's not about whether or not you can do them, but how you're able to do them. It's key to see a doctor. Make sure you're seeing your doctor. Make sure you're seeing them on a regular basis. If it's not in medical records, then as far as Social Security is concerned, it doesn't exist. If you're unable to work and you think you're not going to be able to work for at least 12 months, file early. This is a very long process that involves multiple layers of government. It can be very frustrating. So file early if you think you're going to be out of work for at least 12 months. Make sure you have good communication with your doctors. Make sure you're telling your doctor about all your symptoms, about all your limitations, so they can document those in the medical records, and make sure that their doctor is documenting them in the medical records, and talk to your doctor about it. If you don't think you can return to work, talk to your doctor and find out whether or not they support you. Support from a treating physician is very important in a Social Security disability case.
Okay. Overall, so the story is key, like giving the details. The story is key. Any misconceptions on either side, both sides, about benefits available for people with spondylitis?
Yeah, good question. So some misconceptions just about Social Security in general. When I started over 21 years ago now, and started in working with Social Security, my concept of Social Security was, okay, I'm paying into Social Security, and I'm paying into a fund that's piling up as I work. That's what my FICA taxes are going to. I didn't realize it was a insurance program. I thought it was for retirement. I didn't know there was a disability portion of it. One reason why that is important in terms of misconception is some people think, well, if I take disability, then that's going to drain my future retirement fund. And that's not the case at all. In actuality, it actually hurts you. If you're out of work and unable to work and unable to pay FICA taxes for many years, Yeah, your future retirement benefits actually go down because the way Social Security factors your future retirement is they use your earnings record. And if there are zeros on your earnings record, that's going to lower your future retirement. If you apply for Social Security and you are approved Social Security, those zeros do not count against you. Social Security puts a freeze on your earnings record. So that's one misconception. Another misconception is that it has to be permanent. Like if I go on Social Security disability, I can never go back to work again. And that's not true either. Actually, Social Security has work incentives called a Ticket to Work program that come with the benefit that allow you to attempt to go back to work and continue to receive benefit while you're attempting to see it, testing whether or not you can return to the workforce. For example, Social Security has a 9-month trial work period where they'll continue to pay you for 9 months while you're working. So those are two common misconceptions, I would say.
That's interesting. And so I think that this idea that it doesn't ding you if you go for it, because sometimes, frankly, like I'm sure there are patients and people with this disease or others that sometimes that 12 or 18 months of being home and like doing work toward recovery was a little bit like I had a situation like that where I was out for a while and I applied and then I kind of like hit a plateau and was like, oh, phew, I can get back to work.
Right.
But I think, I mean, this idea that it doesn't have to be permanent is amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
So question, I want to circle back just on like the types of medical evidence, especially for people with spondylitis. Is it the devil's in the details always, but is there a leaning toward, and I don't want to dissuade anyone from applying, but is there a leaning toward what we would call like radiographic evidence?
Certainly, that's important. So, if you have a diagnosis like ankylosing spondylitis, for example, so they're looking for X-rays, imaging that shows whether or not the spine is like a common symptom is fusion of the spine, right? With ankylosing spondylitis, so they're looking for, and that's actually the criteria if you look on the listings for that. Diagnosis or inflammatory arthritis is what it's under. It's looking for criteria like that. So there are that certainly imaging helps to confirm that diagnosis, and also it'll show severity as well. They're looking for limitations in your flexibility or your ability to use extremities if it's affecting other joints, ability to bend and stoop and things like that. So that type of testing that a doctor does is going to be key. Treatment history and medications is going to show severity as well, and just really observations from the doctor is important. So if you have difficulty ambulating, walking, getting Yeah, so any observations that the doctor makes about you walking around the doctor's office or the exam room is going to be key. Do you require an assistive device? That's going to show severity. You're obviously not going to be able to be on your feet for long periods of time if you require a cane or a walker. Not going to be able to carry things very well. All those things are things that Social Security is looking for, all those details. But certainly testing to confirm diagnosis is important. It's hard to get past step two without that.
Okay, good to know. Do you work with people or does your team work with people to ensure that like their documentation is accurate and thorough as they go through the process?
Yes, absolutely. So we talk to the individuals who are applying, and we have access to the medical records once we're on file as representative, and we can see what's in there. And if we see there's a gap or there's a hole, we're going to talk to the individual about that. Hey, there's missing medical evidence, or it's not real detailed. Your doctors aren't putting a lot of detail in the medical records. Some of the things that we can do to overcome that, or obviously talk to them about that. Hey, talk to your doctor, make sure they document it well going forward. But also, can your doctor draft a narrative letter, or can they complete a questionnaire that outlines your how your impairment's affecting your ability to function, and that can help supplement some missing pieces to the puzzle.
Okay, so your doctor can be your guide, and
doctors are going to be an advocate. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Okay. Okay, so now we've gone through the easy positive side of the 1, 2, 3 to get there. For many, what percentage of people have to go through an appeals process generally? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so I can tell you just internally. And your chances improve of getting approved earlier in the process, and just overall if you have a representative like ALSIP to help you through the process. So the initial application, about 50 to 60% of people are approved at the initial application. So if we take your case and we say, yeah, we're going to file the case, about 50 to 60% of people are awarded at the initial application process. That's much higher than the national average. If the case is denied, then it goes to the reconsideration level. So that's the first appeal. Basically, you're saying the person who made the initial decision, I'm asking you to reconsider your decision. Only about 20 to 30% of people are awarded at that level. And if it's denied there, then it goes to the administrative law judge. And that's, again, where you have the actual opportunity to talk face-to-face or over the phone and tell the individual why you're not able to work. And that individual, the judge, will have the opportunity to ask you questions. There will be like a medical expert and a vocational expert at the hearing. At that level, it's more like 75, 80% of people are awarded at that level. If it's denied there, then it goes to the appeals council. The appeals council level is where you say, I think the judge made an error in their decision. I'm appealing it. It's a lower level. The best chance is at the hearing level. Beyond that, there is the federal district court level after the appeals council, which would be level 4. Level 5 would be the federal district court level. That's where that's not a ton of cases go to that point. I want to unpack, if I could, just a little bit about what each level involves.
Yeah.
The initial application, and then how long it takes to get through each level, because I think that's probably maybe where you're going next. But the initial application involves just completing a bunch of paperwork. And oftentimes people think they don't need a representative at that level, but there's a lot of paperwork and there are multiple levels of government involved. And I'll explain what that means here in a second. But there are a lot of deadlines that sometimes, again, people are dealing with a major health condition that they're trying to get treatment and they're seeing doctors and they miss things. And so they can miss deadlines, and Social Security will deny your case for that. If you have a representative, they can advocate on your behalf and make sure that those deadlines are not missed. But there's a lot of paperwork up front for the initial application, just asking about your background, doctors that you're seeing, medications you're seeing, surgeries that you might have had, tests that you've had. Then your work history, we talked about that going back 5 years. They're going to ask about all the details about that, how it was performed. And then once that is done, that application goes to the district or the federal level, the Social Security, your local Social Security office. And they take care of, they process that application, and then they're gonna check to make sure that you're insured, that you've worked 5 out of the last 10 years, that you're not already retirement age, things like that. Once they determine that you meet the requirements of the technical requirements, they're gonna send that case off to the DDS office, the Disability Determination Service, and that's who adjudicates the medical portion of it. And every state has their own DDS office. So like if you're in Illinois, it'll go to Springfield. That's where the DDS office is.
Right.
And they're going to order your medical records. They're going to send you a questionnaire asking you questions about your activities of daily living. How does your impairment affect your ability to cook, clean, shop, socialize, things like that. Once they get the medical records, if there's a gap or they need some additional testing, they might send you to a consultative exam, which is basically one they contract with doctors to examine you to get either some testing or get an assessment on your ability to function. We'd rather your treating doctor give that opinion,
so
because they're
going to
have a treating relationship with you. Yeah,
this
go
is
ahead.
A spot I think that is really important when you are going through the process. And I don't know what SSDI is like, But right, there are times when you're assigned someone to examine you that is really there for, they're being paid to debunk your claim or validate it. And
there's,
is this a place
they're supposed to be impartial, but yeah,
I know. Well, I know, but it, I know.
Yeah. So our part in that would be we'll look at the exam. We'll say, well, sometimes it is supportive, like that consultative exam. That one consultative exam could be supportive. Could give the evidence that Social Security needs to put the case over the top. In addition, one common reason why Social Security will order a consultative exam. So if for example you are alleging spondylitis, but Social Security sees that there are some mental limitations, you got some cognitive limitations, but you're not seeing a psychiatrist or a therapist at all. That plays into it as well, because that can eliminate that can reduce your ability to work if you've got a difficulty concentrating or things like that. So they might order a mental consultative exam, do like, sure, a mental status exam,
like to see if there's some limitations like that.
Right, exactly. So, but yeah, we certainly will look at that, and ways to counteract that is, hey, no, the treating doctor who has a long-term relationship with this individual says that they're not able to function like the consultative exam doctor is saying they can. So, and they should give more weight, assuming, again, that's where evidence comes into play, and making sure you're seeing your doctor regularly, telling your doctor all your limitations and making sure that the doctor is documenting it. Documenting it well, excuse me, that can overcome those negative consultative exams.
Okay. And I read, not that we want to pitch ALSUP here, but
yeah,
this is something that's of high interest, right? Because I'm sure ALSUP there, I'm sure in this, what category of like business model would you put yourself, like provider of
representation? I mean, we provide representation for disability, Social Security disability. Not only that, though, we also have subsidiaries. We've got we help with VA claims as well. So if you've got somebody with spondylitis who's a veteran, we've got we help with VA claims. We also help individuals get back to work through the Ticket to Work program. Medicare can be complicated if you're eligible for Medicaid, what plan to pick and things like that. So we provide all those services, trying to advocate for those suffering from a disability all the way through the process, not just helping them get a disability.
And in general,
that was a long-winded answer. I apologize.
No, this is good. But I have some questions, because I think that like the business model is of interest, right? So in general, across your industry, the business model is someone would pay you a portion of their, if they get approved, as a fee for the work that you guys do to get them toward the approval. And I would,
correct,
you mentioned it, but I would say probably average, right? It's like when you have a lawyer, when you go to court, you have a better chance of having a better outcome. Is that kind of
correct?
Okay.
Yeah, you have a better chance of getting approved if you have a representative. And early on in the process, again, a lot of people don't think that you need it up front, but it is helpful, because a lot of that paperwork can be completed incorrectly or missed deadlines. Since you mentioned fees, so we don't get paid unless somebody gets approved. So if we go all the way through the hearing level and it's ultimately denied, there is no fee. And the government, just for our industry and in general, the government actually regulates how much representatives can get paid. So
that no one's taken advantage of in the process.
Correct. That's correct. Yep.
Okay. No, it's very interesting. I mean, it's something that we don't all think about until you probably need disability insurance.
Right. Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so that first initial level application, that just to give you a day of time frames, I mentioned the multiple layers of the government. Once DDS does their part, it goes back to the federal district office to process it. That whole process can take taking 8 months or more just for the initial application. initial application, and that's significantly increased since COVID. Social Security has had a really hard time adjusting, and as a result of having to shift work from home, not being completely prepared for that, it's resulted in a huge backlog, over a million cases just at the initial level, our backlog. So that process takes eight months. If you have to go to the reconsideration, they're going to take another 8 months or more before you finally get to the hearing level. Wow. Hearing level is one of the quicker levels at this point. It's still going to take probably 8 months or so to get it resolved there. Okay. So you're adding up at that point to 2.5 to 3. 3 years potentially if you have to go all the way through the hearing.
But you cannot apply. So for example, I'm going to use just an example, not spondylitis related, but for example, if you were suffering from a disease and you were losing your sight and your doctor said, you've probably got 6 more months before your sight is gone, more months of work roughly, if you can't do your job, can you preemptively start the process, or do you have to wait for
not the... if you're working, Social Security will deny the case right away.
Okay, so you have to wait until
be out of work. Yeah.
Okay.
And the way Social Security defines work is they call it SGA, or substantial gainful activity. So it's a certain amount. So if you're making $500 a month, they're not going to count that as work. It has to be up to that SGA level.
Okay. And once you have disability, you are restricted from working.
So not restricted from working. You can go back to work again. Social Security has the work incentives that, as long as you let them know that you have gone back to work, if you go back to work and you're successful at it, so again, they have that 9-month trial work period. So at the end of that 9 months, if you're still working, at that point, Social Security will stop the benefit. But there's another 36-month period after that, where if you ever have to go back out of work again for the same condition, Social Security will automatically restart your benefit.
Oh, wow.
So there are some pretty rich that a lot of people, frankly, don't know about, just because the government, Social Security doesn't really advertise it real well. You don't know about it until you actually are approved, and they'll send you something and say, hey, you're eligible for the Ticket to Work program if you ever want to go back to work. The key there is letting Social Security know that you are working, because where people sometimes get into trouble is they'll work and they'll assume that Social Security knows, but Social Security, it takes them a long time to figure out, you're working, we need to stop your benefit. So it could be 2 years down the line, and now you've got a big overpayment. So the key is, if you're on disability, you're receiving SSDI, and you are attempting to go back to work, just keep Social Security apprised and let them know that you are working. They want to know how much you're working and that sort of thing. An employment network, like also employment services, can help you and make sure that information gets to Social Security and that they're aware of it, so they can shut the benefit on off when they need to shut it off. So,
okay. If someone is at a point where they are starting to look into this, any other tools, organizations that you recommend people check out?
Yeah, I would just say seek out a representative. Like also, for example, we do have, and it's not uncommon for the industry, but just a brief free assessment online that would tell you whether or not you may be eligible for Social Security disability. So that's what I would recommend.
And is the SSDI, Social Security Administration website, is it useful, or is it sort of convoluted?
There's a lot of information there, yeah. And it can be difficult to understand. So I would seek help from a representative if you're in that situation.
You talked about one policy.
I would say one thing I would say is create a MySSA account if you haven't done that. That is one thing that can give you an indication of how much you would receive monthly. I think most people have done that by now, but Social Security used to send out statements through the mail to tell you how much, if you're insured for retirement and if you're insured for disability, But you can do that online now. You can create a My SSI account that'll tell you if you're insured, how long you're insured for disability and for retirement, and how much you would receive on disability and how much you would receive on retirement. So that's one thing I would recommend people doing is to create that. And there are some ways, if you do file a disability claim, you can do some things with your claim through that website as well. So.
Oh, that's a great tip. Okay. So policy, you mentioned a good one, which is reducing what the last 10 to 15 years looks like in your life. Anything else going on in that area?
So the new commissioner, Commissioner O'Malley, you may have seen, has been doing a lot of good things and trying to really modernize the system. I think that's the key that they've been trying to do lately is to modernize the system. Mentioned the work history. That is a good positive change because the way jobs were performed 15 years ago, even if they was performed the same way, if you think about it again, the job you did, I can't even remember what job I, you know, what's I was working at also, but what specifically, what I was I doing 15 years ago and how did I perform that? And those question that questionnaire, the work history report, it gets into detail. Like how much did you lift? What did you do on a daily basis? Can you really remember that 15 years ago? And is it still relevant? So that's big, reducing it from 15 to 5 years. From the, on the SSI, side of things, they did increase the or they're not counting some things that counted against you. So there's a means test on that. So income and resources, if you have a certain income and resources amount, so if you have like $2,000 in your bank account, it's going to make you, it's going to disqualify you from SSI. It's a pretty low amount, and there's some other things within that I won't get into too much detail there, but income and resources, they count a lot of, they count some things that quickly take you over that limit. Recently, they've said, well, we're not going to count some of those things any longer, which is helpful. In addition, they're trying to modernize just the way you file the application. There are some forms that, some forms are online where you can file online. Some aren't yet. So they're trying to get all those online. E-signature, making sure that they come up to date and accepting e-signatures and things like that they're doing. They're trying to modernize. So work is a big part of this. So can you perform work? And so if Social Security says you can perform work, they have to cite jobs that you could do that are available in the national economy. Well, the documents that they're using, it hasn't been updated in like 30 years. So, so they're trying to update that. They've been working on that a while, and I think eventually they will do that. But recently they came out with some policy changes that even within those documents, they're not going to cite certain jobs anymore because they're acknowledging that those jobs don't exist any longer. And I credit Commissioner O'Malley. He's made some good changes since he's taken the reins there.
That's great. Maybe they can call their buddies at the Department of Labor.
There you go. Exactly. Right. Well, the documents that they use, I mean, it was created by the Department of Labor, but Department of Labor doesn't even use it anymore. The only entity that uses it still is Social Security for the work information. So,
okay. In thinking through the various things that we have available to us when we're going through this, if you have a availability for like long-term disability through your company, are you eligible for Social Security?
That's a good question. So, so someone who has long-term disability, more than likely their policy is requires them to file for Social Security if you ever have to go on long-term disability. So more than likely, if you're on long-term disability, they're probably, whatever company you have, whatever policy you have, they're probably going to tell you, well, we want you to file for Social Security or any other benefits you might be eligible for. And oftentimes, so yes, you can file and probably will have to file. And oftentimes what happens, it depends on the policy, not all policies are the same. But oftentimes what happens is you're eligible for long-term disability than you will be on Social Security. So for example, if you're getting $2,000 on long-term disability, you might be eligible for $1,000 if you get approved for Social Security. Oftentimes what happens is the long-term disability amount will decrease. So once you're approved for Social Security, long-term disability will decrease by $1,000. So you still get $2,000. It'll just be coming from two different sources at that point is oftentimes what happens.
Okay. It's an offset. Okay. So
usually there's an offset. Yes.
As we wrap our time here, did I miss anything?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I would just say if you know that you are going to be out of work for an extended period of time, file early. It's a very long process, very frustrating process. There is help out there to help you navigate that process. Make sure you're talking to your doctor, have a good relationship with them, make sure they're documenting, make sure you're filing prescribed treatment, that sort of thing. So,
all right. Any other bit of advice when somebody gets in your hands, or thoughts for the future?
I don't think so. Again, it doesn't have to be, I say I don't think so, and then I move right into additional thoughts. it doesn't have to be permanent. Doesn't mean you're going to have to be on disability for the rest of your life. Again, you can't attempt to go back to work. There are incentives for that, the Ticket to Work program. So, sometimes it is permanent, and you find the right medication or a different treatment that helps and you improve and you're able to go back. It doesn't have to be permanent. It's not going to hurt your future retirement. So there is help out there to help you navigate this process.
And where can people find the SSDI Disability Helpline?
So for, I assume you're talking about ALSUP where I work. So ALSUP, you can just go to ALSUP.com and find us there.
Okay.
So.
And then from there, you can do this little assessment.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I think this has been super helpful. So thank you for taking time with us. And again, like I mentioned in the green room, this work makes a difference. Got an impact for people in our community. So we're grateful for people like you.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you very much for having me.
All right. Maybe next year we'll do policy updates again.
Okay. Sounds good. I hope there are more to talk about in a year. So.
Me too. All right. That's a wrap. SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.